Mark, let's get into some of these items that you've been working on. Tell me about this underwater cabinet meeting. What the heck is that?
Yeah, that was bonkers. That was one of the best parts of the trip. I love that bit of the book. I wanted to go and see somebody who really knew about real politics, as it were. I've been talking a lot about innovation, and I wanted to go and see somebody who knew. You have a lot of techno optimism. Scientists or techno geeks will go, everything's going to be solved by technology, we'll be fine. And I wanted to go and see a few people who dealt with the real world, in inverted commas, for want of a better phrase. And so I wanted to go and see a man called Mohamed Nasheed, and he is the president of the Maldives. And the reason I wanted to go and see him was because he's a guy who really understands how to move from somewhere that is terrible to somewhere that is good. Because a year before I saw him, he was a political prisoner. He had been in jail, I think, 16 times, in solitary confinement for 2 years at a time. The previous dictator, they beat him to the brink of death twice. They put laxatives in his food. They put him in a cell that was designed to heat up like an oven in the South Indian Ocean. It was brutal. And now he's the first democratically elected president of a nation. So I wanted to go and see somebody to say, how'd you get from somewhere that's so terrible and so dark to someone that's where you are now, where you're the president. And then also to talk to somebody who is a president, has to deal with the day-to-day. And he has a big problem of moving his country forward because the previous regime had meant a lot of the tax dollars had gone into, and I'm not kidding here, gold-encrusted toilets at the presidential palace to people. That's great, isn't that? James Bond villain type stuff. If a gold-encrusted commode doesn't say, I'm a self-serving, whatever, what does? So
forget the people.
Exactly. So I went to see this guy. And also because the Maldives is one of the lowest lying nations on the planet. There's not an island out of their nation that is more than 6 feet above sea level. And therefore, they're very worried about climate change and sea level rise. So I wanted to talk to him about, how he views that and what he's doing about it. And I went to see him talk about all these things, but I was also invited as one of four people that wasn't in the government to be in this underwater cabinet meeting, which was basically a PR stunt for them to get international coverage to draw attention to the fact that they're worried about climate change and sea level rise. It got huge coverage, and the world's press was there, and it was just one of the most bizarre events of my life, because I'm basically in this crystal clear blue lagoon. I'm underwater. There's, I think, about 15 or 16 government ministers, all in scuba gear, all signing a document that's being passed around. And, it's the first time I think you'll ever see a whole meeting, dressed in tight-fitting rubber. And it's not something to do with the English aristocracy. And it was just quite incredible. I ended up swimming back to the shore with the president. I was next to him, and he gave me the underwater hand signal for, "Are you okay?" And I responded with the hand signal for, "Yes, I'm okay," because there isn't a hand signal for, "Oh, my God, I'm an underwater cabinet meeting in the Maldives. How cool is that?" So that was pretty cool. And, he's very, very good at that. He's in the process now of turning his country carbon neutral because he thinks that's a good example for everybody else. And I did ask him, I said, "Look, how do you move from a place like you were to becoming president, and also a place where you're a tiny nation, which is under threat, as he sees it, to a place of positiveness?" And he said, "Well, always by imagining that there's a better future. It doesn't matter how dark it is, if you can keep hold of the idea that it can be better, then that gives you the wherewithal to move out from those dark times." I mean, he should know. I thought, this guy was tortured to the brink of death twice, and is now a complete optimist. I think it was very instructive. He said, "Thoughts are real. They become material quite quickly once you've had them. If you can believe something, you can make it happen," which again, I think is very American dreamlike in a way. And it's certainly something I believe, getting a book deal, for instance, is not the easiest thing in the world, but you say, "Look, I can do this." And then, if you really believe it, and then you tie that to your intellect, you can really make things happen. I thought he was a great example of that. And I say underwater cabinet meeting, as one of the best moments of my life. The Maldives is not a bad place to hang out for a week, I tell you.
I love it. Now, tell me about your meeting with George Church. He's the one, of course, who launched the Human Genome Project.
Yeah. He's an extremely fascinating and important man.
What does he see in the future?
Well, what he's trying to bring forward now is something called personal genomics revolution. So he's doing this incredibly interesting project called the Personal Genome Project. So the Human Genome Project basically has Well, Craig Venter said this. It basically has told us nothing in that, in terms of therapy. We can sequence our genomes. We can look at them and go, okay, we've got a bunch of data. But what we don't really understand very well at the moment is how your genome, your genetic code, interfaces and interacts with your environment. So why is it that your sister gets colds but you never do? You know, why did Uncle George die? Was that because the heart attack he had was always something that was in his genetic code, or was it because he worked in a laundry and ate mustard sandwiches and that had some kind of interaction with his genetic code? So what George is doing at the moment, this is one of the things, two particularly interesting things he does, but this is he's sequencing the genomes of 100,000 volunteers. And then he's asking them a bunch of deeply personal questions about their health, their lifestyle. Mm-hmm. He's taking their medical records, and they're going to track them for, you know, over a period of years. And the idea is that you will be able to eventually go, okay, if you have this genetic marker or whatever, then bananas are bad for you. That's why you're getting ill. You know, so stop eating bananas because there's an interaction between your environment here and you that's making
something you probably never would know.
Exactly. And the thing is, we don't know these things at the moment. But by sequencing enough people, and as sequencing gets cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, we'll be able to do this. And the idea is that one day we'll all have our genomes sequenced. And if we want to, we can share that information with our doctor. And a really good thing about this is, at the moment, we have this absolute treasure trove of life-saving drugs that we don't use. And the reason we don't use them is because even though they might cure or help 99% of people, quite often they will be dangerous or even fatal for 1% of people. So this is why the FDA is incredibly cautious, because you can't have a drug that has 1% failure rate, right? You can't kill one out of every 100 patients, okay? But if you have your genome sequenced, you may be able to look at that data, look at the drugs on offer and go, okay, you 99 people can get this drug. You have to have another one. You have to have a combination of a couple of other drugs because the normal one will kill you. And what that means is the price of drugs could start to get really low, because at the moment, drug companies, there's only 1 in 5,000 drugs makes it to be approved for human use. So drug companies have to cover the cost of the development of all the drugs that don't make it, the 4,999, in the one that does.
That's
which is
right.
This is why they're so expensive. If we will have cheap genome sequencing, we can suddenly have an avalanche of life-saving drugs that we already have. But that does require us to have, as I say, this cheap genome sequencing. And the good news there is the first human genome costs something like $3 billion to have done. So $3 billion by the publicly funded effort, and then Craig Venter spent another $100 million, I think, on top of that. Now there's a man in Harvard called David Weitz who thinks he's worked out how to do a human genome for $30. Now, that's a massive advance in just 11 years. So this leads to the idea that in the future, you and I could have our own personal medicine where we can walk into the doctor, and also your kids can walk in and they can go, looking at you, Junior, you really should avoid, peanuts, or don't eat bananas and peanuts in combination because that's going to have bad stuff for you, bad implications for you. So you get to stop having diseases because you can change your environment in advance. So I think that's absolutely fascinating, and it could see there's huge healthcare debate in the States, as you know, going on, but it could start to see a lot of healthcare to get a lot cheaper if we invest in this technology. And I think that move that he's making, that study that he's doing, is one of the most important studies in medicine at the moment, and could genuinely revolutionize the way we interface with our health.